what to do, Shawty.
Murder stories lull the baby to sleep, okay?
We're a little weird at first, but you get used to us.
We're your favorite sisters.
Except for if you have your own sisters, probably.
No, but I'm gonna be, you know, your favorite.
We're gonna bump them bitches out of there.
Kick rocks, other sisters. No one likes you.
Kick rocks.
Wake the fuck up or shut the fuck up. No one wants to hear about that.
You just told them I like to poop. It'll be an adventure, and we hope that you come along for the ride. Please subscribe.
You'll make the baby cry if you don't.
Yeah, don't upset Ethan by not subscribing. That's just rude.
Welcome to Suspicious,
a podcast with two sisters
who are a bit obsessed with true crime,
unsolved mysteries,
extraterrestrials,
and all things strange.
Stay a while.
Let's get weird. Hey guys, welcome back to Suspicious.
Hi. Hi, we're back. And hopefully we fixed all of the audio issues.
Not
minus
hopefully.
Our voices.
We did. Well, yeah, we can't fix that. But we did fix the technical difficulties that we had with my microphone for the last two episodes.
Yeah, shockingly, it was not my audio.
So I had to have like three audio tracks for Angela. One at loud, one at medium, and one at soft, depending on where the microphone was.
Depending on how heavy I was breathing.
But anyways, so computer settings are a thing.
Hi, welcome back.
Welcome back.
Welcome back, welcome back, welcome back.
Quick question for our audience. Who here knows the Lizzie McGuire movie? Because
nobody.
I was singing a song. Everyone.
Nobody.
Because
don't.
I was singing a song to Angela from the Lizzie McGuire movie. Hey now, hey now. This is what dreams are made of. And she's like, okay, making up songs over there. And I'm like, yes, that's from Lizzie McGuire.
Nobody freaking knows. And then she tried to
Everyone
give me.
Everyone knows.
Listen, no. Because you tried to give me shit about it. But
I said,
how
culture
many times,
yourself. Girl.
How many times. Yeah, culture myself. How many times during this podcast has she gone, I've never heard of that. I've never seen that. I don't know. Like,
but I know Lizzie McGuire.
Every single time. Every single time I brought something up, she goes, I've never seen that. I've never seen that movie. I don't know.
Well, watch better movies.
I have to culture myself. Oh, okay.
Anyways, I'm going to put a poll up on our Instagram. Who has seen the Lizzie McGuire movie? I just want to know.
Yeah.
I guarantee you.
Because our audience is not 8-year-olds.
No. Oh, my God. Okay, but our audience, a lot of them are my age.
No.
And we watched fucking Lizzie McGuire movie. No. Guaranteed. Anyways, tangent. Angie's going to take a sippy break. And
sippy sippies. Oh, I have – can I do a couple friendly neighborhood shout-outs?
Sure.
Thanks. I just wanted to say – I know, awkward.
He's waiting for him. Just thanks. The end.
Thanks, the end. I just wanted
I
to know if
I was going
to
do it right now.
I didn't say I had any. I just wanted to know if that was a possibility. Okay, bye. No, I just wanted to give a couple podcasts that I've been listening to
slash watching from the bushes.
Spying on, peeping on, communicating with. Little shout out. So if you would like other cool podcasts to listen to, I recommend as well, besides listening to us and subscribing to us, duh. But you should give From Crime to Crime a listen and like and subscribe. They are super cool as well. They have great stories as well.
It's a cool podcast because it's a female and a male. So Erica and Bryant, they're pretty cool.
Yes, they have good stories as well. And then the other one I wanted to also give a little hey to is Till Death Do Us Part podcast, which is a husband and wife duo, and they tell husband and wife murder stories. Give them both listens and likes. And
tell them we sent you.
Tell them I said hi. They'd be like, oh, great.
Those weirdos.
That weird chick. Bye.
So, anyhoosh, if you didn't check our last episode, go back and listen. We had some pretty interesting stories. And again, sorry if you hear my cat bells in the background. I've got two cats now. It's a thing.
She's turning into real cat lady.
Love it. Here's some more.
she's embracing it. I don't think I've told the story on the podcast yet, but I told Dave I want more cats, and he said no, because then we can't get a dog. So then I joked with him, I'll just get more black cats, because my cat right now is black, which I love black cats. They're my favorite. So I said, I'll just get more black cats and then slowly just bring them into the house, but he'll only ever see the one black cat around the house, because most likely he'll never see two at a time. So I'll just have all these black cats around the house, and he'll just think it's the one black cat hanging out.
He'll never know.
I'll just have like 15 cats around the house. As long as I keep that litter box clean and not smelly, he'll never see more than one cat around the house.
Not a single hole in that plan.
Nope. I don't see a problem with it. Not one bit.
No, perfect. Perfect plan. Tell me how that goes.
Yeah. So on episode 9, that we our previous episode, because this is episode 10. On episode 9 that we previously released, on the previous episode, we talked about Thelma Todd. Was it murder? Was it suicide?
Was it aliens?
Who knows?
You tell us, guys.
And then we also talked about a serial killer.
Alfred Gaynor.
Jennifer made a WWE reference in the title.
RKO out of nowhere.
Okay. So for episode 10.
What's your stew to da?
My stew to da. Oh,
God. Your story of the da. If you don't know that reference, go back a few episodes.
Oh my God. That was the best when I re-listened to it, because I totally forgot about that. I legit like laughed so hard I almost cried when I was listening to
that. That was my favorite part.
That was the best. Like,
and then you just kept saying today, and I was like, I couldn't then not hear it as ta-da.
I know. I laughed so hard. I almost want to.
That should be a thing, though.
We should just clip that and then just randomly.
It's your stew ta-da.
Stew ta-da. So now that's all I'm going to think about. So my stew ta-da. my stew ta-da.
Ta-da. My stew is.
So, the Dells Tada, Mastu Tada, is a story about old Tadas.
A stew about old Tadas?
Old Tadas.
Sounds like we're speaking another language. Okay, but for real.
Okay, what is it about? Now we lost every single follower we have. And I liked how you clipped it out last time after I talked about how every level, like the 6 followers we have, are like, unsubscribe, unsubscribe, unsubscribe. We lost like every single one. You're like, I'm just gonna not put that in the episode.
No one needs to know.
Ta-da is not ta-da. It's the fucking wheeze every time. Your old man wheeze, dude.
Your laugh makes me laugh too.
So, remember that one time where I did an episode?
Oh my God. I swear to God.
Do you
ta-da.
Remember?
Okay, ta-da.
Get to the story.
Get to the point, ta-da.
Ta-da! Do you remember the time I did a story that was not a murder? Story it specific. Was,
the gun shooting couple?
Nope.
That was not about murder.
Well, that technically was not about murder. But this was a location one. Do you remember the time I did it? Yes.
The USS Mary.
Yes, correct. You are correct.
Ding, ding, ding.
Chicken dinner.
Is it ghost dick chicken? Except I cut all that out from the last episode, so no one would know what it means.
Damn it. If you don't know the ghost dick, nobody does. Because Jennifer cut all that goddamn funny ass shit out. So now that episode probably sucks because she cut all her funny ass shit out. Because her audio is fucking ghost dick. Her audio ghost dicked it.
Our audio. They fucked it right in the face.
Jennifer's audio fucked it right in the face and ghost-dicked it.
You ever been ghost-dicked? That sounds like ghosted, but ghost-dicked.
Ghost-dicked.
Oh, that's a thing. We should make that a thing. Like, when someone hits it and then quits it, it's called ghost-dick.
Oh, my God.
Trademark.
Stop trying to make... Jen, stop trying to make ghost-dicked a word.
Ghost-dick happen. It's never going to happen.
It's never going to happen. It's so fetch. Please tell me you have at least seen...
Yes, I've seen Mean Girls. Good Lord. If I've seen Lizzie McGuire, I've seen Mean Girls. That honk was for you.
Please leave that in. Oh, my God. I was like, Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ. Don't sass me to da, okay? Don't get so sassy to da. Okay, let's finally fucking get this story on their way, okay? Ta da.
I was gonna say that.
I know you were. I fucking got ta-da. You. People okay. are like, okay, unsubscribe. Ta da. This story is over.
Block that shit. Is there a way to block a podcast?
Can I just unhear this? Can you just what is that movie with I don't know if you're gonna know this, but Jim Carrey.
Sunshine of
Spotless, the
Eternal
Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
Spotless Mind, something like that.
Yeah, let's just spotless mind this podcast out of my brain.
Yes, or Butterfly Affected or something.
Okay, so like with the like that time I did that beautiful story on the SS Queen Mary. Today I'm going to do another story on a location because sometimes my stories are not always about murder.
But mine are.
But Jen's most likely always are.
Psychopath.
But this is a ghosty kind of story. This is like, well, this is like an interesting, like, kind of dude story and then a location slash and then ghost story thing. So it's interesting, I think. I hope you think
it's interesting.
Today's story is going to be about F.O. Stanley. Have you heard about him? Do you know?
Faux Stanley.
And the Hotel Stanley. Do you know about the Hotel Stanley?
Hotel and the Hotel?
Motel, Holiday Inn. Say what? Say if your friend starts acting up, switch and take her friend.
Motel 6, we leave the light on for you. Sponsored by Motel 6. I feel like I've heard of the Hotel Stanley, but I don't know about Faux Stanley.
Okay. So let me tell you. Ready?
Let me tell you.
Let's go. Okay. So Freeland Oscar Stanley was born June 1st, 1849. P.S. This might be a long story.
Sorry. Buckle in, bitches.
Buckle the fuck up. Okay. So he was born 1849 in Kingsfield, Maine. He was an identical twin. He had a younger brother who was a twin. Oh, obviously, he's a twin. I just said he was a twin. Named Francis Edgar. Freeland and Francis, they were the second and third children of seven to Solomon and Althea. The Stanley family was not wealthy, but education was something that they really valued in their family. A knowledge of science, poetry, and music was encouraged at a very young age. So at age 9, the brothers, and I'll refer to them when like they do things at like the same time or together, I'll just refer to them as the brothers because it's a lot less confusing.
For sure.
So.
Or you could call them Faux and Fee. Faux and Fee Stanley.
Faux and Fee. No. No. So the brothers, at age 9, the brothers started their first business together. They refined and sold maple sugar. They used their hard-earned money to buy woolen clothes for new school suits. And they bought a copy of an arithmetic book, which they worked every equation in the book. At age 11, the brothers were taught the art of violin making by their great uncle. At age 16, F.O. had made 3 violins, and he would continue to make violins throughout his life. Many of these are concert quality pieces, and they are still prized today by collectors and musicians. By age 20, or at age 20, both brothers began college and initially wanted to become educators, but Francis left school to pursue a career as a portrait artist. F.O. continued his education, and after college, he accepted a position as a headmaster of a high school in Maine. This is where he met Flora, who was a teacher and a pianist, and they would marry in 1876 when F.O. was 26 years old.
If they have kids and don't continue the F name, missed opportunities. Just saying.
You'd be extremely disappointed.
I'd be very disappointed.
At age 31... F.O. came down with tuberculosis, and unfortunately his younger brother Solomon died of TB at age 27 that same year. F.O. believed that his survival depended on a less sedentary lifestyle, so he decided to change his career and go into manufacturing. After a fire destroyed his first business venture in 1882, the brothers decided to create a photographic product, and by the age of 35 in 1885, they had established the Stanley Dry Plate Company. They perfected the process in the factories and marketed all over the country and quickly rose to predominance and made a small fortune. I believe also that these plate things that they came up with, actually still some of them are still used today in like the photo industry. Yeah, photography industry and stuff. Yeah. They're definitely like really smart.
What year is this?
1885.
Okay.
So they made a small fortune with this dry plate company. And then from 1894 to 1896, F.O. and Francis built giant luxury homes. They had summer homes built. And F.O. and Flora emerged as well-to-do members of society. And when the brothers were 47 in 1897, they purchased and built a Hunwell Club, which was a special organization for their neighbors and friends. It was like a social club that had a ballroom and billiard tables and bowling alleys.
That sounds fun.
I know, it's fancy. F.O. loved bowling and playing billiards and making violins, and the brothers immerse themselves in exciting activities and technological advances and advancements. Francis began construction of automobiles after his wife had fallen off a motorized bike and swore she would never ride again. So he basically told her that he would make something like safe for her, and he decided to create an automobile. So he began to focus all his intentions on this automobile project. And after contemplating a long time, he determined that steam was going to be the most practical for the car. And the brothers built their first car in 1898. And they entered their car in the Boston Car Show and impressed the crowds. And then after that, the steam cars began to be produced.
And so it was their first car that they built, but it wasn't like the first car ever.
No. Okay. Because there was like three options that I was reading about that they had to go with for engines and stuff when they were doing their cars. So they were, it was between steam motion or like steam locomotion, combustion engines, or like electric type of like engine stuff. So they went with steam because they thought it would be more the most efficient, most practical.
Yeah.
So after the car show, they started to produce these steam cars, and they came up with a company called the Stanley Motor Carriage Company. And then the company basically just started taking off. And at age 49 in 1899, F.O. and Flora became the first of many motorists to reach the top of Mount Washington in their car, which is the tallest peak in New England. And then in November of the same year, F.O. gave President William McKinley a tour of D.C. in the Stanley automobile. And this marked the first time that a sitting president had ridden in a car. And then
by
By 1900, the car company disbanded due to disagreements between investors, but the brothers decided to basically start again from scratch, and they changed and improved on their original designs. And at age 51 in 1901, the brothers restarted production of cars and under the new and improved company name called the Stanley Motor Carriage Company. At age 53 in 1903, F.O. was stricken with a resurgence of tuberculosis, and this time it was life-threatening. He stood at 5'11", and when his TB kind of happened again, he only weighed 118 pounds, so he was super thin and frail. Oh, wow. And he basically, like they said, he basically had like 1 foot in the grave.
Or he was just trying to be a supermodel. We may never know.
Holy 14. The most highly recommended treatment of the day at that time was fresh, dry air with lots of sunshine and a hearty diet. And like many lungers of the day, as they call them, he resolved to take the curative air of the Rocky Mountains in Colorado. So Flora and F.O. decided to live in Denver in March, or move to Denver in March. And they arrived, and after one night of staying in this famous place called Brown Palace Hotel, F.O. arranged an appointment with Dr. Bonney. Dr. B. I'm going to call him Dr. B.
Dr. B it is.
Dr. B. So Dr. B, he was a preeminent American expert of tuberculosis, and he was an advocate for home treatment and recommended that they actually leave the hotel and rent a home. And F.O. spent the remainder of the winter in a home, but his symptoms didn't improve. So in June, Dr. B recommended that he stay in Estes Park, which had a climate similar to a posh resort for TB that was in Switzerland.
Fun fact, our cousin just moved there.
After staying in a primitive cabin during their first summer there, but his health did improve, and being impressed by the beauty of the valley, F.O. and Flora vowed to return each year. And by the end of 1903, F.O. purchased Estes Park and began construction of a home there. By 1905, it was completed and it was grand. It had 4 bedrooms, gracious living area, a modern kitchen. It had a basement with space for billiard tables. It also had a detached garage for a violin shop, plus a turntable that would allow him to pull in his steam car, and it would turn it around so that he could just pull back out and not have to try and reverse the car. Hella fancy for the day, dude. Hella fancy for the day. It's fancy.
I want
now.
That. Just kidding. I don't mind backing up. I'm okay with it.
No, I'm just saying it's fancy now. Like, I can imagine back in the day. It's hella fancy. So in 1906, at age 56, the brothers earned a place in history with the specially designed rocket racer, which broke the land speed record at Daytona, Florida, for going 127.66 mile per hour over 1 kilometer. And in 1907, at age 57, F.O. had all but recovered from TB, and he had decided to turn Estes Park into the resort town and began construction on the Hotel Stanley. He was tired of the like rugged lifestyle that he had been living, because obviously he was more comfortable in the high society that he was living in back in Maine. So he built a hydroelectric plant up in the mountains so that he could power the hotel. He basically made Estes Park into an actual livable town and brought modern luxuries and things there, electricity,
yeah,
everything there. So
he made it livable.
Mm-hmm. So he started to, so the hotel was being built, and it's built in a colonial, I don't know why that word was stumping me, a colonial revival style.
Okay.
And it basically, it was going to be like this grand hotel, and it was going to cater to the wealthy urbanites that encompassed Effo's social circles. So in 1909, when the hotel was complete, it had 48 rooms for guests, each sharing one bathroom. The hotel had a fully functional...
Hold on. Mm-hmm. 48 guests and one bathroom?
No. So 48, each sharing one bathroom. So I think 48 rooms, I think each two rooms had a bath. They shared a bathroom each. Hang on.
Because if it's one fucking bathroom.
No, not one bathroom for the whole thing.
I'm like, good Lord.
No. I think it's just, it's how it phrased it. But I think I think guests like between two rooms shared a bathroom or something like that. Okay. Instead of having your own bathroom in your hotel room.
Yeah.
It's shared bathrooms.
As long as it's not one.
No. I don't believe it was just one bathroom.
Better be a big ass fucking bathroom.
So the hotel had a fully electric kitchen and a steam powered laundry. It had a hydroelectric elevator. It was powered with electric lights and telephones throughout. There was a concert hall complete with a grand piano, which was a gift to Flora. During the day, the guests would golf, they would bowl, they'd go horseback riding, they would take motor excursions, and at night, the guests would have formal dinners and play billiards view concerts. And it was said that Effo and Flora were notoriously kind to children who visited the hotel, as they had no children of their own. In 1917, at age 68, the brothers were ready for retirement, so they stepped down from management of the hotel. And tragically, in 1918, Francis, so Effo's brother, was killed while driving a Stanley automobile on a country road in Massachusetts. Effo sold his interest the same year in the Stanley Motor Company. So he sold his part in that company. Yeah. In 1939, after 63 years of marriage, Flora suffered a stroke and died soon after in their home in Colorado. And in 1940, at the age of 91, Effo died on October 2nd due to a heart failure shortly after returning to his home for the summer in Estes Park. So that's the story of Freeland Oscar Stanley, who built this Hotel Stanley.
Yeah.
So now let's talk about the actual Stanley Hotel and the haunting slash history behind that of the hotel itself. So a lot of people just call it the Stanley Hotel. So that's how you might actually know it, is the Stanley Hotel, not the Hotel Stanley. Technically, it's called the Hotel Stanley.
Look up to the Hotel Stanley, Colorado. You know, like Hotel California.
There's some ghost surprise.
A dick in your eyes. Ghost dick.
No one's going to know what that's about because you got it. Okay, so let's talk about one of basically how the hotel became super famous was because Stephen King stayed there. Stephen King wrote a book called The Shining. So let's talk about Stephen King for a second. Okay. So in the 70s, the Stanley Hotel was experiencing kind of like a downward trend. You know, it was it was kind of fading. The accommodations were dwindling. It wasn't as modern as it had been. There was other accommodations coming out in the area that had more modern amenities like heat and air conditioning. The reputation for it being haunted also wasn't quite a selling point back then. So it seemed like the Stanley was basically gonna kind of come under being closed down, you know.
It peaked.
It was basically like it was getting ready to be like shut down. It was gonna get closed. But in 1974, up-and-coming horror author Stephen King and his wife checked into to the hotel, and they were living in Boulder for a short time, and King was struggling with his latest project called Dark Shine, and he was looking for like an isolated setting for his novel, and locals and suggested Estes Park for the inspiration. So he heard about the Stanley and he wanted to check it out. And so they found themselves basically as the only guests that night in the hotel. And the next day, the hotel was actually closing for the season. So they were served dinner in the empty dining room. All the chairs kind of were on the table, kind of like the movie. I don't know if you've seen the movie. She has not seen the movie. And now she's,
I'm not gonna
can't
admit
give me
it
shit. She can't give me shit for stupid Lizzie McGuire.
Still give me shit for Lizzie McGuire.
So they went back to their room, which happened to be number 217, which we'll talk about later. And King wandered the empty hallways and corridors and listened to the canned music through the speakers. And he visited with a bartender, Grady, in the hotel bar. And because where the Hotel Stanley location is, it's remote and the size is very grand, it becomes kind of eerie and desolate. And so this sparked King's imagination and started to run wild. And he claims, quote, "It was like God had put me here or put me there to hear that and see these things." And in a retelling that night, King said, quote, I dreamt of my three-year-old son running through the corridors, looking back over his shoulder, eyes wide, screaming. He was being chased by a fire hose. I woke up with a tremendous jerk, sweating all over, within an inch of falling off bed, and I got up, lit a cigarette, sat in a chair, looking out the window at the Rockies, and by the time the cigarette was done, I had the bones of The Shining firmly set in my mind. So, The Shining was actually adapted from the book to a movie that was directed by Kubrick in the 80s. And there was a famous bathtub scene that took place in room 237.
I think I'm confusing The Shining and Psycho. Never mind.
Yes.
I'm like, oh, is that the bathtub scene where she's behind the curtain and they have the knife? And I'm like, no, that's Psycho.
No. So there's a famous bathtub scene that takes place in room 237. That's because the Timberland Lodge in Oregon, where Kubrick exterior shots were filmed, did not embrace ghosts quite like the Shining Hotel. And asked about that number be changed to a non-existent room, basically. So they changed the number. So when the movie turned into a huge success the huge revolution for horror films kind of turned around, it was no secret that Stephen King was not a huge fan, but it's easy to understand how Jack Nicholson's portrayal of Jack Torrance was both brilliant and misconceived. King wrote that Torrance's descent into madness was slower and more surprising plummet. Jack Nicholson, the actor, while perfectly capturing the character's final and fatal temperament, was arguably a little bit extreme. Kubrick also portrayed Wendy as blubbering, weak, not to mention emotionally the emotional torture that I guess he put the actress through, kind of real life, to kind of get her to act like that in some of the scenes.
Spirit of it.
Yeah. But if you're a Stephen King fan, you would know that he is known for writing strong female characters, and Wendy was no exception. So I don't think he really appreciated how they had her
portrayed in the movie.
Because she is kind of annoying in that movie. It's like, you kind of want to stop her. No, she doesn't die.
Oh, spoiler alert.
I don't think it's a spoiler. The movie's been out since 1980. That movie's almost 40 years old. Like,
it's if you haven't seen
it,
me.
If you haven't seen it by now, we're not spoiling it for you. Sorry, don't get mad. You had 40
You're
years to see
it.
It
for me. I haven't had 40 years because I am not 40 years old. I've only had 34 years to see it.
You've had plenty of time to see it. Okay, so let's talk about the Stanley ghosts. Boop, boop. So the Stanley Hotel, or the Hotel Stanley, I keep flip-flopping because people call it both ways. So sorry. It's confusing. But basically, it's a repeat guest on most haunted lists. Like, you'll always see it on there. It's called the Disneyland for Ghosts. It's been on countless paranormal investigation shows, including Travel Channel's Ghost Adventures, Sci-Fi's Ghost Hunters. Guests can actually kind of take tours and get in on like the ghost action by taking a Ghost Adventures package where they're assigned a room on the fourth floor, complete with ghost hunting equipment. They actually get a little mug that says Red Rum on it, which is also something from the movie.
That'd be fun to do, actually. Something like that.
Yeah, that'd be fun. Ghostly occurrences are reported in almost every room of this vast hotel, from shadowy figures to eerie laughter, flickering lights, to items moving on their own. The Stanley Hotel has all of your kind of favorite phenomena there. And if you get too spooked, just find a member of the cleaning staff, because apparently the ghosts hate vacuum cleaners. And every time someone with a vacuum cleaner comes with a vacuum cleaner, machines go haywire and turn off and the plugs come flying off the wall. It's also said that if you do go on these tours, pro tip, take 5 or 6 quick shots back to back to try and catch like
an orb spirits or moving, something.
Not orbs, but like spirits moving. You might be able to catch something possibly. Also bring tons of backup batteries because they will drain your batteries. It's also said as well, reports of doors opening, abruptly slamming shut, seeing shadows, hearing children laughing and like getting chills and cold spots as well. Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's talk about specific places. Room 217, that's the room that Stephen King stayed in. Throughout the Overlook Hotel from The Shining, the fictional hotel in the book and the movie, there are characters within this room 217, and the one that King actually stayed in, and it's the most predominant one in the novel. There is no woman in the bathtub like they talk about in the novel and this room, but it doesn't mean that it's not haunted. So in 1911, during a large storm, the head housekeeper, Miss Wilson, was lighting lanterns in room 217 when there was an explosion and Elizabeth was blasted through the floor into McGregor's dining room below. Damn. And believe it or not, she did survive with only 2 broken ankles. Now she spends most of her afterlife still taking care of the room. Guests have reported items moving, luggage being unpacked, lights turning off and on. Ms. Wilson is also very old-fashioned, and she isn't a fan of unmarried guests staying in the room and sleeping in the same bed. So some couples have reported feeling a cold force between them. When they wake up, often they find man's things being packed with his luggage by the door.
That's hilarious.
Actor Jim Carrey stayed in room 217 when the Stanley was used for filming Dumb and Dumber. And he reportedly got so spooked that he ran from the room half naked in the middle of the night. some of the film crew also got the creeps from this room. There also is reports of orbs and distortions being caught on camera. Mr. and Mrs. Stanley have also reportedly been seen hand in hand watching over the hustle and bustle of the grand staircase.
I told you there would be orbs, son.
One and done, son.
When you said that she only had 2 broken ankles, I was thinking of this audio. I think it's from TikTok. I'm not sure if it comes from anywhere else. So you probably don't know it, but they're like, I'm built different. I'm like, she's built different. She only had 2 broken ankles. Anyways, other TikTokers will know.
Yeah, I don't know TikTok.
She built different.
Okay, now let's talk about the vortex.
The vortex.
So from an architectural standpoint, the staircase between the floors in the hotel, the main staircase is stunning. Wait, what? Hang on. I can't read my handwriting. Hang on. The staircase between the floors in the main guest house is a stunner, but the area has also been dubbed the Vortex. It's a natural spiral of energy, and it is also known as the rapid transit system for ghosts that haunt the hotel.
If you're from the Bay Area, it's like the BART for ghosts. Rapid transit is what you called it.
If you're from the Bay Area, you know that sound. Boop, boop. See, now you got it, right? Tell me that wasn't the sound.
But I was also in my head picturing like the air brakes or whatever sound of it too. Like right? In combination with that. It sounds like a weird bus. Anyways.
So now let's talk about the concert hall. So the concert hall was built by F.O. as a gift to his wife, Flora. The stage features a trap door for theatrical entrances and exits, has a lower level that once housed a 2-lane bowling alley. The hall underwent extensive repairs to renovate it in 2000, but it's a favorite spot for Flora Stanley because she loved to play the piano. She's known to play the piano at night. Another spirit who's there is named Paul. Paul is known as a jack of all trades. Among other duties, Paul is used to enforce the 11 p.m. curfew for the hotel back in the early days, and guests report hearing someone telling them to get out late at night. Construction workers who were doing the work on the floors in the concert hall when they would feel like nudged several times until I left, and then they assumed it was Paul nudging them to get out. Paul is a big fan of tour groups, often flickering lights, flashlights on request. Also in the concert hall is Lucy, who is quite possibly a runaway or a homeless woman who took refuge in the hall. She entertains requests for communications as well with flashlights. Historians are not really sure about her pre-death connection to the hotel, but she's reported to be in the concert hall. The fourth floor. Guests staying on the fourth floor report hearing children running around, laughing, giggling, playing. Closet doors tend to open and shut on their own. More than a century ago, the entire fourth floor was a cavernous attic. Later, it became lodging for female employees and children and nannies. So now the part of the fourth floor where the female quarters were now is part of its room 401. And then part of it's now in 428, which basically to stay in room 428, you need an extra badge of honor, like bonus points. You need a badge of honor to stay on the fourth floor anyway, but you need like bonus points to stay in 428 because there's reports of footsteps, moving furniture. There's a really friendly cowboy who appears in the corner of the bed.
So obviously, how do you get badge or points?
Like the term badge of honor, like extra bonus points. Just like you need to have like bravery to go.
You need balls. There. You need cajones.
Yes.
Big ones, hairy ones.
Yes.
Okay. Got it.
So obviously many friendly cowboys spent the night or two at Stanley over the years, but there's no indication of anyone dying in the building, any specific cowboy. So they're not sure who this cowboy who has been seen in that room is. But they believe the spirit might be Rocky Mountain Jim Nugent. Because he appears to ladies and sometimes gives them a ghostly kiss. Speaking of ghost dick. I should have wrote ghost dick on there. I didn't even think about it. Let's talk about the grand staircase again real quick. There's antique mirrors and portraits that kind of distract your gaze when you're going on the staircase. But like I said before, it's a popular passage for ghosts. And in 2016... there was a tour from Houston there and they snapped a bunch of photos, and apparently there's apparitions that were seen. on the staircase after when they returned home. They found these on their pictures, and they spotted an apparition at the very top of the staircase. They don't remember seeing these people on this, like anyone else on the staircase. So that's why they think it's also like kind of a portal.
Yeah.
Sorry to jump around. Now we're going to talk about the ice house. So the ice house is before there was indoor refrigeration, the Stanley had an outside building that housed large blocks of ice where you would put your food. So basically kind of like a large refrigerator, but outside.
Yeah.
Because they didn't have refrigeration. So it was remodeled into a museum containing some of the original Stanley Steamer cars. And
Stanley Steamer?
Stanley Steamer cars.
I don't know why all of a sudden it's just, you said it earlier and I didn't think anything of it. And then all of a sudden, because you said Stanley Steamer, like back to back, I was like, Stanley Steamer gets carpets cleaner.
Yeah, I'm sure it's probably still their company. I'm sure it is.
Interesting. Okay.
I like how it's towards like almost the end of the story and you're like, Stanley Steamer
gets carpet cleaner.
So in this ice house, there is said to be two spirits that have been inside, seen inside. Billy, a shy kid who shows up, and then they don't really say who the other person is. But Billy is one of them. Billy and an unknown person.
Oh, Billy.
Oh, Billy. There's also a pet cemetery. So long before King's novel of Pet Cemetery, there's actually a pet cemetery that stood outside of the Stanley Hotel. There are two beloved pets interned here, and they make their appearance at the hotel. Cassie, who's a golden retriever, and Comanche, who's a fluffy white cat. Both have been heard and seen around the property. There are, so let's talk about now, underground caves. There is a 75-minute historic night tour. You don't have to be a guest at the hotel to take this night tour. You can take it. You just have to book it. You can just book it in advance if you're there.
Yeah.
But you can take this tour. You'll get an in-depth look at the underground cave system underneath the hotel. The caves have a high concentration of limestone and quartz, which many people believe to be able to like capture paranormal activity or just have a high sensitivity, like high vibrations, and they kind of just lock traumatic events and things like that into them. It's said that it was used by employees to get around the hotel, and it would seem that there's at least one of them still down there. Current employees say they smell home-baked goods down there, and they linger in the tunnel, but there's no source of where the smell's coming from. Delicious. They attribute, I know. I mean, if it could smell like anything, I guess.
Baked goods, pretty good option. Could smell like shit.
It could. Caves usually smell weird anyway. They smell like
a donkey fart, a stale donkey fart.
Stale donkey farts. But if it smelled like baked goods, I'd be like, yeah.
Stay down here. It
smells like cookies.
Y'all got a bed?
I'm going to lick the walls. Okay. They attribute this to a pastry chef who worked at Stanley when it opened. And there's also apparently a gray cat who's been seen down there with bright green glowing eyes. He's
Professor McGonagall.
It's not known that he's from the pet cemetery, so he could. It's a mystery, like how he got there or whatever. But so there's a cat.
So it's like a live cat apparently. Or like a dead, like a ghost cat.
Ghost cat.
Got it.
It says he is not known to be from the pet cemetery, so perhaps he came from whose mysterious tunnels once led, wherever they led to or from.
Yeah.
I don't know. He's somewhere. He's a ghost cat from somewhere.
He's a mystery.
Okay. And then we're going to talk about the hedge maze.
What's a hedge maze?
About the hedge maze. Like a hedge maze.
Oh, maze. Okay. I thought you said maids. M-A-I-D-S. Maze. M-A-Z-E.
Had seen the movie, you would know what I am talking about.
Okay, well, maybe I'll watch it after this.
You're not going to watch it.
Maybe I will. $5. You'll pay
I'm
me $5?
No, I'm not.
I watch it.
Oh.
You better pay me.
Don't talk shit when you think my earpiece
I said
out.
You I better pay me.
I ain't paying you shit. So, in the open area in front of the hotel was originally a long driveway for the Stanley steamers to promenade guests to enjoy the views up to the hotel. And in 2015, it was replaced with a hedge maze. They had held a competition to choose from like over 300 global entries on what the design would be. This was done with connection. This was done to connect the hotel to the Kubrick version of The Shining, which introduced the suspense-provoking hedge maze. In the novel, the lawn of the Overlook was adorned with like topiary animals and things.
Mm-hmm.
While there are no specific ghosts reported here, inside, people just tend to get panicky and get like trouble breathing and stuff while navigating the maze. So,
sounds fun.
Yeah. And that's pretty much my story about the Stanley Hotel and F.O. Stanley. You can do ghost tours, and there's a restaurant and a bar and museums, and there's a spa there. There's all kinds of stuff. You can stay overnight. They offer tours and things daily. There's stuff for adventure seekers and nature lovers and obviously ghost adventure hunters and horror fans. So,
you down a clown? You down a clown?
No.
You afraid to clown?
I don't like clowns.
No, it's not actually about clowns. The phrase, you down to clown, like, you want to go? To the Stanley?
Maybe one.
You're going to have to say that again because you're not by the microphone.
Maybe one day. Maybe one day. I said maybe one day.
I said maybe. I said maybe.
It sounded like you said,
we're gonna go to the Stanley. We're gonna catch a ghost. We're gonna slap a ghost dick.
Stanley steamer ghost dick.
They get carpets cleaner.
Oh my god, what was that?
I didn't mean to go that deep.
Okay, before you start your story, can I go grab some water? I'm like hella thirsty. I'm suffering from the dehydration.
Water sucks. It really, really sucks. Water sucks. It really, really sucks. Gatorade's better.
Oh my god. Ghost just possessed my sister. Be out, demon. Be out. Oh my god. Please leave all of this in. This part.
I wish it wasn't in a video. That'd be great.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the snorting too is the best.
Daily ball left my band.
You could hear him leave through the snorts. He almost choked on your water.
Here's the last of it.
Oh my god.
Okay, go get your damn water. So there's actually quite a few coinky dinks between our two stories.
Ooh.
I feel like, anyways.
Okay.
So, and you'll probably have heard of this. Most people probably have. But
is it a dating game killer?
No.
Oh, I don't know. I was just guessing. I just took a shot in the dark.
So the things that, okay, the things that kind of like tie it together, yes. Unintentionally, time frame. It takes place in the 1880s and 1890s.
It's old timey. My favorite it's time.
Old times. It's not Tada, it was yesterday. And yesterday. another thing that tied it
never
together is yours was about a hotel.
It wouldn't even let me.
I'm gonna leave it in.
No.
It's like my background music.
Yesterday. Oh, I thought you were going to still keep talking. I thought I was doing background music for you.
I thought you were going to keep singing.
Oh, yesterday, all my troubles seem so far away.
A far away. Yesterday,
all my troubles seem so far.
Beautiful. One of the other things that kind of tied it together was your story was about a hotel, and my story was kind of about a hotel called the Murder Castle.
Ooh, A.J. Holmes?
Yes.
I know him.
Oh my God, I know him.
Oh my God, I know him.
Oh my God, I know him.
Also, a show that you have not fucking watched. They talk about him on American Horror Story.
That is correct. I have not seen American Horror Story.
They talk about him on the American Horror Story Hotel. It's
I'll put it on my list.
Yeah, you keep saying that, but you don't.
No, I didn't say that to you.
You did.
No, I'll add it to my Netflix list or wherever it's on. I'm not saying when I'll watch it, Hulu. But I'm just saying, okay, I'll add it on my Hulu watch list.
You better. It better be the next one since I pay for Hulu now.
I'll show you that I added it to the list. I'm just not saying that I'm starting it. I'm still in the middle of my rewatch of One Tree Hill. Oh, God. No shame. Oh, anyway.
Okay. Yes. Go ahead. Tell me about.
This is the story of Henry Howard Holmes, a.k.a. H.H. Holmes.
Yay. I'm so excited.
Better known as Dr. Henry Howard Holmes or H.H. Holmes, or previously known as.
It's a WWE reference. Triple H.
You remember one. Previously also known as Henry Mansfield Howard, Herman Webster Mudgett was born May 16th of 1861 in Gilmanton, New Hampshire.
That's also a terrible, terrible last name.
I mean, Herman isn't a great first name either, but Herman Webster Mudgett.
Mudgett?
M-U-D-G-E-T-T.
Mudgett. That's a shitty ass name.
It's kind of a shitty name. So you can kind of tell why he changed it. But for the purposes of the story, I'm just going to call him Holmes or Dr. Holmes so that we're not confused with 18,000 names.
You should just call him Holmes. Sup, Holmes?
Okay. So he was born into an affluent family. He was the third of four children, born to a stern postmaster, Theodate Page Price, and an extremely religious mother, Levi Horton Mudgett. Some reports said that he grew up a mama's boy, and although he grew up privileged, he did have it rough as his father was an alcoholic, and all of the children would often catch his wrath. Now, he liked science and found confidence designing scarecrows and perpetual motion machines. What?
Designing scarecrows?
That's what I heard. Okay. He was said to be unusually intelligent at an early age. And in 1877, at the age of 16, he graduated from high school. He attended Phillips Exeter Academy, which is a highly selective co-educational independent school for boarding and day students between the grades of 9th and 12th, and offers a secondary postgraduate program. It's located in Exeter, New Hampshire, and is one of the oldest secondary schools in the United States. Fancy. That following year, on July 4th of 1878, Holmes married Clara Levering. They later had a son, Robert Levering Mudgett, who would grow up to be the city manager of Orlando, Florida. Now, it was reported that he was abusive and violent to his wife, though I didn't get many details on that. Holmes went to the University of Vermont from the years of 1879 to 1880 and dropped out halfway through as he was not satisfied with the school's curriculum. He then began to attend the University of Michigan in 1882, where he studied human dissection or medicine and surgery. Same.
Dissection?
It was medicine and surgery, but it's like basically the same thing. Human dissection. And he graduated with his medical license in 1884.
I want to study human dissection, please. Do you want to be
a doctor?
That's
not weird, right?
No, I just want to study the human dissection piece of it.
How do you chop up a body? Just for funsies.
Chippity chop. So, chopping up a body. Yeah, chop.
Hey, twins. So Holmes' life of crime began with various frauds and scams. Anything that he could do to make a quick buck. While attending the University of Michigan, he stole corpses and would perform experiments on the bodies and then use them to make false insurance claims and collect the money. During the first year of medical school, he worked at on a cadaver nearly and probably every day. He had 3 formal lectures a week on various body parts and then would work on the cadaver on those particular day's lessons. Holmes later claimed that staring at dead bodies all day long turned him into a murderer. At the time, he was not doing well money-wise, and actually his wife was the one whose money got him into school to begin with. Around that time, tuition was about $100 to $200 a year, so he had to scrape by and get the cash or he couldn't continue to take the courses. The school's janitor, Doc Nagel, was keeper of dissection corpses and frontman for a trade in dead bodies. Holmes was around sometimes when bodies would be donated from questionable sources and found that by digging graves and selling bodies, he could pay for his tuition. And that is where the thought of getting money for dead bodies ended up becoming an obsession for Holmes. He shared secrets with another classmate, Robert Laycock. Great name for porn.
Also, trade in dead bodies kind of sounds like it would be like a cool like metal band name. Like a front man for, like, you could be a front man for trading dead bodies. And welcome to the stage, trading dead bodies. Chopping bodies to the floor.
So Robert Laycock, who would spend 20 to 40 hours a week dissecting bodies with Holmes.
I think it's pronounced Laycock.
It's not. It's L-A-Y-C-O-C-K.
Laycock.
So they fantasized about a get rich scheme using dead bodies. Their dream was to be able to take out life insurance.
Get rich quick.
Want to get rich quick? Get some dead bodies.
Dead bodies.
Their dream was to take out life insurance on someone and collect the cash. They actually wanted to collect on a family, so multiple people. So they planned to take from the dissection room 3 corpses, a man, a woman, and a girl. They took out a life insurance of $40,000, and Holmes would have himself as the final beneficiary and would collect the insurance payment and then secretly split the cash with Laycock. But they had a hard time being able to get 3 bodies.
Laycock.
Laycock. Mr. Laycock, do you?
Yeah, you should say it like that every time.
Holmes was not the best student. He finished near the bottom of his class, and the faculty actually had to have a second vote as to whether or not they would give him his medical degree. He just barely scraped by to become a doctor, and at that time he decided to leave his wife, the one who began his medical career by paying for it, and decided to chase another woman in Moore's Park. No, and decided to chase another woman to Moore's Fork, upstate New York.
Sounds like a stand-up gentleman.
Totes. After leaving the university, he spent the next 2 years moving from job to job, city to city, and running small scams. So from 1884 to 1886, he did a number of odd jobs at various places, including Moore's Fork, New York, and Philadelphia, before he finally settled into Chicago, his notorious hunting ground. He was involved in a few cases regarding the disappearance of a boy in New York and the death of another boy in Philadelphia who died after taking drugs from the pharmacy where Holmes worked. He denied involvement in both of these cases, and that is when he first decided to change his name to Henry Howard Holmes. As for the dead children, the police never linked them to Holmes. It's only in retrospect that it's wondered if he had something to do with them. So in 1885, Holmes indicated starvation was staring him in the face, and he was finally forced to sell one and then the last of his 2 horses. He was out of school and had not had easy access to corpses to use for his money-making schemes, and he was getting in trouble money-wise. So he wrote to his college conspirator.
I mean, he couldn't have just gone down to the body emporium and just gotten all the bodies he needed. I mean,
he didn't
How
have,
do you not have access to just bodies? Like, he just thought he was going to have access to all these dead bodies?
You know, he didn't try hard enough, really, is what it comes down to.
He wasn't ingenious enough. He could have just, like, worked at a
mortuary?
Well, I was going to say mortuary. No, I was going to say a cemetery.
Oh, yeah. So he wrote to his college conspirator, Mr. Laycock, and they began to again hunt for corpses. Their scheme called for no less than 3 bodies, but no doctor could call for 3 bodies at one time without suspicion. Holmes was finding it very difficult to find enough corpses, so he decided to pretend to kill himself under his birth name. Holmes insured himself for $20,000 in favor of his wife. In August of 1886, he arrived in Chicago and immediately got a job at a drugstore owned by Elizabeth S. Houston and her husband, and used that job to pay for his insurance premiums. He even sent divorce papers to his first wife to lay the groundwork for the disappearance, and also before marrying Myrta Belknap, who was in on the plot. So during this time, Holmes waited for a substitute corpse. Wow. During this time, Holmes waited for a substitute corpse that would fool the insurance company, but he found it difficult to find a corpse that would pass as a good substitute for his own body. In January of 1887, Holmes and Myrta Belknap tied the knot. Mr. Houston mysteriously disappeared in the months that followed and was believed to be dead. From the proceeds of his scams at the drugstore, Holmes bought the drugstore from Mrs. Houston, who, like her husband, disappeared mysteriously after that. He ran some more schemes from the drugstore, and when he had enough money for funding his future plans, he left the business. Now, ironically enough, his failure to switch himself for a dead man drove him to attempt to actually kill himself. And after telling a policeman that he was going to kill himself, he was sent to a psychiatric facility in Philadelphia in 1888. He left after 2 months with a new plan. Freshly killed corpses would be much better, so Holmes graduated from bodies fixed in formaldehyde to fresh. Holmes then lured his best friend to a hotel, Dr. Robert Laycock, and killed him by overdosing him with laudanum and put the body on ice in the hotel tub. The face somewhat resembled his own, and he realized $20,000 would be coming to him after just a little bit more effort. So he dumped the body, dressed in his clothes and identity papers, to be found by the insurance company and cashed in the $20,000. Holmes used that payday to purchase a piece of land across from the drugstore, where he went on to build an elaborate 3-storied hotel, which the locals dubbed as the Castle. Built on 601 to 603 West 63rd Street at Wallace, it took up the whole block. The building would go down in history as the site for all of the horrors that he would perpetrate on scores of people.
Horrors?
Like, scores. Horrors. And maybe whores.
Horrors?
Horrors, horrors, and scores.
Scores of horrors and horrors.
The castle was then later dubbed Murder Castle due to the horrors that occurred Murder inside. Murder Castle.
Murder. But the spirit of the man there.
Holmes called
it. We
have
the best accents, by the way. We do the best.
We lines. Nail it every time.
Excel.
Killing the accent game.
We're murdering the accent.
Murder. So Holmes called the hotel the World's Fair Hotel, as it was built for the upcoming World's Columbian Exposition, but it was never really. It never really turned into a proper hotel. Holmes had issues with almost every vendor and suppliers and was accused of insurance fraud when part of it burnt down. And it was always a shady project because Holmes seemed to have a difficult relationship with anyone involved in it. The hotel did end up opening in 1893. The hotel was a complete maze with a host of rooms, deceptive doors and hallways, stairways that would mislead people, and a number of other confusing and misleading structures. It was constructed in such a way that none of the victims could find a way out in case they ever tried to escape. Holmes was the only person who really knew how the home worked. The building had storefronts on the first floor, and then the hotel part on floors 2 and 3, along with his offices. He started utilizing part of the first floor as a barber shop. And he used the money to install all the latest inventions like gas lighting. Not gas lighting, but gas lighting. He got his furniture mover, Wade Warner, to pretend to be an inventor of a new glass vending machine. And he had Warner build a glass furnace in the basement to fool investors. Holmes began the next phase of his murder spree, the business murders. The next on the list was that of Warner himself. Holmes had secured 2 signed checks from Warner and later added the word 1,000 and the necessary numbers. And by passing them to the bank, a very large sum of money was transferred to Holmes. His business fraud would be exposed if Warner found out about the fake checks. There was a large kiln in the castle basement, and it was in that kiln that Warner met his death. Holmes turned the oil full blast, and the fire was so hot inside that in a short period of time, not even the bones of his victim remained. All the while, Holmes was actively digging up bodies, selling their bodies to medical schools, and he even recycled the caskets and resold them for a profit. His trafficking of bodies was in full swing. Holmes then said that he accidentally murdered another doctor that he was in business with, Dr. Russell. It was an accident. Concerning a confrontation involving non-payment of rent due, he struck him to the floor with a heavy chair. Holmes sold the man's body to a medical school in Chicago. Now that he had an easy way to get rid of bodies, his business killings became routine. After considerable back and forth letters, he was able to entice Charles Cole, a Southern Spectator, to the castle. He, quote, struck him a most vicious blow upon the head, end quote, with a piece of gas pipe. But it crushed his skull to such an extent that his body was almost rendered useless to the party who bought it. But in the end, the body did sell, and he continued to make Holmes a profit. In his pursuit of finding the most perfect dissection corpse, he installed a vault in his top floor office. Gas could be piped inside, and he found a new way to make businessmen sign over money. Quote, I enticed a wealthy banker named Rogers to within the secret room to force him to sign checks and drafts for $70,000, end quote. At first, he refused. Finally, after starving him, the nausea along with the gas was too much, and Rogers signed the documents. Chloroform was the perfect aid to Holmes, leaving no evidence that these people came to their demise in anything other than a natural way, if he could avoid hitting him over the head with a chair, that is. Now, he got his supply from the clerk of the hotel's drugstore, Mr. Erickson. Blueprints of the castle helped experts later understand the idea of the thought processes for the factory that he was creating for murder. He had different tradesmen complete different sections of the design so that no one person could tell that he was shaping the home into a slaughterhouse. Holmes leased out 5 shops on the ground floor and rented out offices and bedrooms upstairs. He had to get the corpses from his office on the 3rd floor through the rest of the hotel unseen. So he could drag a body unseen from his office suite to the bathroom next door. The bathroom had a trap door that Holmes could put the body in, and it would fall into the bathroom on the floor below. Holmes would go downstairs to that bathroom and take the body into the dissection lab next door. At the far end of the lab, there was a bottomless closet. A body pushed into this cupboard dropped onto a corpse catchment platform below. To reach the body, Holmes went back into the bathroom, which had a secret stairwell down to the platform. Holmes would then slide the corpse into a chute, and it would fall into the basement. This is literally like chutes and ladders type shit. Visitors said that the hotel's maze-like layout seemed purpose-driven to bring on disorientation. Holmes had converted some rooms into killing chambers. He fitted stopcocks outside so that he could make the gas for the gaslights flow into the bedrooms. Holmes could then also chloroform guests as they slept and shift their bodies to the central chute. Holmes built a special box lined with tar so as not to leak any blood as he took his victims to market. Holmes continued the practice of insurance fraud and produced enough policyholders to claim almost $250,000, which at that time is obviously, which today is about $7.4 million if you were to equate it. He was killing for money, but he was also killing for easy money. Chicago's Hahnemann Medical College had trained mechanic Charles Chappell to turn corpses into medical exhibits. Holmes gave him a job in the castle, first having Chappell saw the arms off of a man's body, and later showed him a woman's corpse that he had processed for sale. The body had been skinned by splitting the skin down the face and rolling it back off the entire body. In some places, considerable amounts of flesh had been taken off of her.
Yummy.
So yums. Holmes installed two vats in the basement. One was filled with carbolic acid, a chemical that dissolves flesh, and the other vat contained bleach to whiten the bones. Holmes gave the bones to Charles Chapel to mount into display skeletons, which he would sell. And in the late 1891 and all throughout 1892, Holmes ran a fully integrated system of murder, corpse preparation, and body sales. He then began his next phase of killing, the sex murders. He now turned his attention to women. He was handsome and charming and powerful, and women were drawn to him. Officially, he lived with his wife, Myrta, and their baby, Lucy, in Wilmette, just outside of Chicago. Myrta described him as a devoted husband who doted on their child and also described him as an animal lover and that they always had to have a pet. Holmes also loved to staff his businesses with women, typists, shop assistants, you name it. With the newfound women's right to work that was happening at the time, he even set up a woman's employment agency, which provided him with a pool of victims. Holmes rented out the castle's jewelry shop to Ned Connor, a watchmaker, who arrived with his wife Julia and their 8-year-old daughter. Holmes gave them a room above the store and helped them out by giving a job to the watchmaker's 17-year-old sister. Now that they were living in his debt, Holmes decided to live out his dissection room fantasy of a family murder. Within months, the sister was dead. Holmes would confess that when she rejected his sexual advances, he poisoned her. The mysterious death ended the marriage of the watchmaker and his wife. So at that time, Julia Connors then began an affair with Holmes, and Julia became pregnant. Couldn't have that, so on Christmas Eve, 1891, Holmes presented Charles Chapel a satchel containing the stripped bones of Julia Connor, and the severed body of her 8-year-old daughter was also buried in the castle's pit. When he killed the daughter, it was clearly like a trying to get rid of the witnesses kill.
Yeah.
Holmes was introduced to a beautiful typist, Emmeline Sigrant. Holmes offered her a job in the castle. For the next 6 months, Holmes wooed the 23-year-old with flowers and trips to the theater. Emmeline disappeared in early 1892. Holmes told other castle tenants that she had left to be married, but in truth, Holmes gassed her to death because she wouldn't marry him. Holmes used to use his vault to house the money he made from his insurance fraud schemes, but was now using the vault as a torture chamber and way to suffocate the women that he was sexually attracted to that would not reciprocate. Now, thousands flocked to Chicago for the World's Fair. Holmes had rooms waiting, but as the fair opened, Holmes thought he found an even bigger money earner. A Texas heiress answered his ad for a typist. Minnie Williams was a cut above Holmes' usual victims. She was an actress, an elocution or speech teacher, and she had something that Holmes found even more attractive, $50,000 worth of land in Fort Worth, Texas. But Minnie Williams had a sister who could claim the family land should something happen to Minnie. A plan then began to be seeded in Holmes' mind. And on the 4th of July of 1893, Holmes picked up Minnie's sister from Englewood Station. Holmes took the sister to the castle, stating that Minnie was there waiting for her. But when they arrived, Minnie was not at her desk and the vault door was open. So he got the sister into the vault and began to torture her slowly and suffocate her. Certain chemicals were used on her to enhance the torture. On the soles of her feet, there was some kind of chemical that was used where when she was likely using her feet to push up against the vault door to try to open it, it left traces of her foot impression and skin burnt into the door. When the sister was out of the way, Holmes invited Minnie into his office, where he used the gas to confuse her and had her sign over ownership of the land to him and subsequently killed her. In 1894, Benjamin Pietzel, who was a friend of Holmes and also an accomplice in some of his past crimes, agreed to do a scam with Holmes where Pietzel's death would be faked and they would share a $10,000 life insurance payment. However, Holmes never got a cadaver, which he would say was his friend's body. Rather, he knocked his friend out with chloroform and then set him on fire. Holmes later said he murdered 3 of the 5 children of Pietzel. 2 of their bodies were later found within the hotel. So for 4 years, he murdered his guests and their children, employees, and lovers to sell bodies as dissection specimens. Holmes was finally apprehended by the police on November 17th of 1894 in Philadelphia after they got a tip from an inmate named Hedgepeth, who was one of his accomplices in an insurance scam. Holmes' first conviction was that of insurance fraud, but the police had grown suspicious of his activities at the castle and decided to investigate there. What they found were skeletal remains of scores of victims, including children and a number of other evidences, which confirmed beyond any doubt that Holmes had killed all those unfortunate people. By then, it was also clear that he had murdered Pietzel and his children as well, and he was convicted of those crimes in 1895. During the trial, he confessed to the murder of 27 other people, but his stories were full of inconsistencies and false statements. The police confirmed 9 of his alleged 27 murders, but based on the evidence found and the account of the neighbors, they suspected that the number could be anywhere between 20 and 200 victims. After his arrest in 1894, Holmes left a chilling legacy now being studied by one of Britain's leading criminal psychologists. Holmes recorded audio files of his confessions, thoughts, memoirs, which were purchased by a New Jersey collector and examined by many historians. Holmes was then found guilty and sentenced to death by the Court of Philadelphia for the murder of Benjamin Pietzel and hanged on May 7th of 1896 at the Philadelphia County Prison. His beloved castle was gutted by fire following several explosions in 1895. Holmes' great-great-grandson came forward in 2017 and said that he had proof that his great-great-uncle was Jack the Ripper, stating that he escaped death and found a way due to his trickery. He stated Holmes' diaries describe viciously murdering and mutilating prostitutes in London. They do not believe this to be true, however, as his body was exhumed in 2017 and was found to be largely preserved as Holmes got his wish and was buried in a casket filled with concrete. A DNA test performed, and they confirmed that it was, in fact, the body of H.H. Holmes. And that is my story.
Are you sticking to it?
I am.
Casket of concrete?
In a casket of concrete. Well, is there anything in that story that, I know you know the story, so is there anything you didn't know?
I guess I didn't realize how much, like, towards the end, like, how much they did to try and, or how much they thought he was Jack the Ripper. Like,
I don't think that people actually thought he was. No.
Like how they thought he like escaped death.
It was just his great great nephew that said that.
Oh.
It wasn't multiple people. It was just his great great nephew that was.
Because there was this, okay. So there was this show thing that I've seen. But they try to make all these connections to make Holmes the Ripper. And they're like, oh, maybe he was here. Oh, look at this timeline. And like, oh, it could work. And it's just like,
Yeah.
It's just like you're grasping at straws for it. It's like, no.
Yeah. So his great-great nephew said that like he had diaries that like talked about killing prostitutes in London. But like I said, they exhumed his body and was like, nah, this is H.H. Holmes, bitch.
Yeah.
Right where we thought he was.
I think it's just kind of like funny too how like he was getting away with it for like a while, like with this whole like secret rooms and doing that kind of stuff, and then he just got like I don't know if he just got sloppy or careless or like
at least from my research it was that one of his associates he picked something
more prominent.
No, one of his associates who was in jail ratted him out.
Oh.
About insurance fraud. And so the police started looking at him for insurance fraud and then was like, this castle situation seems sketch. And then like uncovered more. But you work with seedy people, you're going to get some seedy results, you know?
Yeah. I get it. That's why you don't work with seedy people. You cut those seedy people out your life.
But his, the way that he built his hotel, though, like with all the secret passages and like the tunnels and the stairways and the, all the things, it's like pretty interesting. Like, you got to have a smart, you're a smart person for sure, but like you're using it for the wrong reasons.
Yeah, you're using that noggin in the wrong way.
Wrong way. Anyways, so that's my story. That's it. That's all she wrote.
Did she write more, though?
I did. Let me check my notes. Nope. She didn't.
What?
The end. Fiend.
Do you like how back in the olden times, oldie days, that you could just be a doctor by learning learning dissection and then barely like pass?
Well, no. That was my joke. My joke was that he studied human dissection. He studied medicine and surgery, but essentially that's human dissection. But also, he was like such a bad student that the faculty had to vote twice to whether or not to pass him.
I guess he'd be a doctor. Like, that's the doctor you want to doctor on you.
Jesus. So, yeah. Interesting stories this week. Hopefully y'all found them interesting. So
stay at the Stanley.
I was just going to say.
Don't stay at the murder castle.
Don't stay at the murder castle, but let's all round up and go to the Stanley.
And don't have Holmes be your doctor.
And don't let ghosts put their dick in your face. Ghost dick. So come back next time, please. Don't leave us.
We're trying to put them out monthly. We did. We put it out monthly.
We're doing our fucking best.
We suck at life. We're trying.
Speak for yourself, bitch. I'm thriving. Just kidding. Anyways, so thanks for listening. Come back next time.
We'll have more stories for you and stuff.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
And though they're very long, just pluck them
till they're gone.
There you go. I'm not alone.
Don't get murdered by Holmes. Don't go to his castle.
Or you'll end up just dismembered. Bones. Just bones, bitch.